recently resumed ballistic missile testing after a self-imposed moratorium aimed at negotiating a lifting of U.S.-led sanctions, which remain in effect. Meanwhile, South Korea has further developed and tested missile technology and deployed several advanced U.S. weapon systems, raising concern in Pyongyang.
The U.S. and its allies are increasing their military pressure on our republic. All this is raising serious concern that the ravages of the war 72 years ago could be repeated here. Our measures to build up national defense capabilities are the legitimate and righteous exercise of our sovereignty to defend our national security and territory against military threats.
South Korea said this year's drills will include 11 field exercises, amphibious operations, and an air carrier strike group. South Korean officials have said the joint military exercises with the U.S. will begin on August 22nd, and for the first time since 2018, include field training. As new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol pivots to a hardline approach to Pyongyang, inter-Korean ties appear destined for greater tension. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Another day, another railway strike, bringing half of Britain's rail network to a grinding halt. Organized by the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, the 24-hour industrial action has seen more than 40,000 railway workers walk out in a row over job security and pay at a time of soaring inflation. Any hope of an 11th-hour settlement has now been all but dashed.
We're just outside one of the busiest train stations in London, where members of the RMT union have formed a picket line demanding a fair deal. And they're saying if there isn't a negotiated settlement soon, there will be more walkouts in the weeks ahead.
Those words echoed by the head of the RMT union, that industrial action is the way forward.
I can't think of a way at the moment because we've been negotiating for 2 years. But it would be interesting if me and Grant Shapps went head-to-head. We could see how we got on with that, if that's not too flippant.
Grant Shapps is the transport secretary. Under him, the rail network and the subway have seen billions of dollars in cuts and offered below-inflation pay rises, described by the strikers as paltry. As widespread as the disruption is support for the railway workers. Today, the strikers found Britain's shadow transport secretary joining the picket line in central London.
When Grant Shapps and Liz Truss come on the telly and say to you that it's someone else's fault, it's the striking rail workers' fault that this dispute is happening, what a load of nonsense. The Trade Union Congress had a legal opinion just a few weeks ago that showed definitively that it is the government who are agitating for this dispute. And it needs to be resolved. It needs to be resolved fairly and justly and quickly for the sake of the travelling public.
The travellers, too, want the dispute resolved quickly.
But I love the railway. I love to travel by train. I want to keep doing it. And I don't want to keep thinking, oh, God, is it going to be, you know, unreliable?
Well, I totally get why they're striking. Obviously, it's an inconvenience for me, but I'm willing to make an exception.
There are more railway walkouts planned for the coming weeks. There are also reports of unrest among teaching staff and National Health Service employees. More disquiet is on the horizon as Britain awaits a new prime minister. Saeed Purizza, London.
Dismissed us and it has cost taxpayers 70.
After the warm-up bouts of debates featuring multiple leadership candidates, it was time for the final two to square off in a live televised debate. The head-to-head was the first opportunity viewers, including the estimated 170,000 members of the Conservative Party eligible to vote in the leadership race, could see Liz Truss, Foreign Secretary, face off against former Chancellor Rishi Sunak. Each wasted little time attacking each other's records and credentials and clashed heavily on their individual taxation plans to bring the country out of its worst cost of living crisis in generations.
We are an outlier. Everybody understands that COVID is a 1-in-100-year event, and trying to pay it back straight away, so quickly, that we actually damage our economy, that we end up causing a recession, that we end up in people being out of work and that hard-working taxpayers who do the right thing have seen their taxes rise, despite the fact that we promised in our manifesto
Hang on, Faisal, I think that is wrong. You just mentioned three countries. Do you know what mortgage rates are in the US at the moment? Do you want to use them as an example? Their mortgage rates are almost 50% higher than mortgage rates in this country because they're borrowing so much.
I'm sorry, this is scaremongering. Canada actually has project fear.
The candidates vying for the country's top job have not shied away from going after each other's political juggler. Some of the exchanges have been brutal, with a former chancellor accused of talking down to his political rival, while Liz Truss has honed in on Rishi Sunak's immense wealth. Now, Tory grandees are fearful that whoever wins this vote, it's actually the Tory party with all of this mudslinging that will be the eventual loser.
Former Mayor of London Ken Livingstone has been keenly observing the leadership race. Polls have Rishi Sunak trailing Liz Truss amongst rank-and-file Tory members, and with ballot papers being sent out in early August, both candidates want to build momentum. The results of the leadership ballot will be revealed on September the 5th, still years ahead of a general election that will see the nation have the final say. Amina Taylor, London.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been raided once again by Palestine supporters, who claim to have inflicted significant damage on the property. The building belonging to UAV Engines was hit last Sunday as part of a wider campaign by Palestine Action activists to harass and hamper the activities of the international arms firm Elbit Systems.
Palestine Action claim that their latest direct action was in retaliation to Israeli regime attacks on the Palestinian city of Nablus in the West Bank on Sunday morning, killing at least two Palestinians and injuring many more. The group also vows that as long as Israeli aggression against Palestine continues, so will their campaign, targeting not just Israeli arms manufacturers in the UK, but also their partners as well.
Following Sunday's action, supporters gathered to protest outside UAV's gates in solidarity with the activists who were detained following the direct action.
The drone parts that are made here are used, are tested on the captive population of Gaza. We know that these drones have killed people, and we're here today to stop the arms trade overall, but specifically against Elbit.
Palestine Action have always said, if you continue with this violence against the Palestinian people, then we will retaliate, we will resist, we will come back, we will shut down your factories.
The attack by Israel on Nablus is a common occurrence across occupied Palestine. The lack of action by Western powers to rein in Israeli aggression has inspired more aggressive activism. Palestine Action say their relentless raids have successfully forced the closure of two Elbit sites in London and Oldham. A spokesperson for Elbit acknowledged the incident, claiming it was an attack by a violent group. Although no one was harmed during the raid, Palestine Action's sites remain squarely fixed on UAV engines, so locals can expect more of the same scenes going forward. Robert Carter, Shenstone.
Several days ahead of the lunar month of Muharram, people in Afghanistan are preparing to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam and grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Imam Hussein. On Kabul streets, people have held Muharram exhibitions, where they provide necessities for mourning rituals.
We have been holding such Muharram affairs for more than 20 years. We deploy necessities for mourning ceremonies across Afghanistan. However, Muharram always has its own prosperity, but this year it is very different for our people. As we see, people are set to mark a widespread and more passionate Muharram.
Afghans also turn the mosques and public religious places black to express the emotion of grief on the martyrdom anniversary of their third imam.
We are preparing to hold Muharram mourning ceremonies in Abul Fazl Shrine. The servants and lovers of Imam Hussein are decorating here with black as an old Afghan religious culture. God willing, we will host a sizable population of mourners during Muharram days, especially in Ashura.
With the Taliban responsible for ensuring security, Afghan Muslims, especially Shias, hope that they can hold their festivities in a peaceful space.
As you know, in the past years, there were security threats, especially by the Daesh terrorist group. Now that the invasion has ended and the Taliban are in power, I hope they tighten the security in advance and provide a safe ground for Muharram mourners across the country. They should cooperate and engage with the people and mourners to foil evil schemes.
Muslims around the globe largely commemorate the Battle of Karbala to keep the spirit of resistance and fight against arrogance alive. They also honor Imam Hussein's sacrifices, renewing allegiance with his ideals. Every year, millions of people in Afghanistan passionately mourn the martyrdom of Imam Hussein during the month of Muharram. Now here in the capital city of Kabul, preparations are underway for large processions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Global Stage for Talents. The 5th International Stage Stars Festival wrapped up with the announcement of winners, who have been competing in 4 categories of singing, voice acting, show hosting, and sound impression. The top performances from each category won the golden mic and a cash prize.
The festival was a place for more serious competition between those who have a say in a stage performance. I'm so happy to be chosen by the jury as the best show host of the contest.
It was an amazing event for talents. I'm so glad to be part of this. Talents from all across Iran and many parts of the world competed in the festival, so winners should be proud of themselves.
Held in Iran's city of Rafsanjan, the 2-day event brought together participants from 14 countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Nigeria, and Turkey, to flaunt their neck for stage performance.
The scale of this contest is global. Many of us participants did not have any idea we could be stand-up comedians or show hosts. But when we got on stage here, we ourselves discovered our own talents.
I really love that, seeing that all people around the world are coming here and presenting themselves. It's a very great feeling. Of course, they will be progressed and they will develop yourself when they will got the result.
The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say the competition has been tough, and those who stood out are real stage stars.
We tried our best to pick talents who really acted like professionals on stage. Not only should they care about the standards and principles of a stage performance, but they must innovate, improvise, and stand out.
This festival acted like a university for stage talents. It taught a lot of lessons about stage to participants, especially for those who failed to win the contest.
Organizers say this contest is not just about scouting for stage talents. They say the event helps shine a spotlight on talents and lead them to their community.
The 5th Stage Stars Festival is aimed at bringing stage talents to light. Many of the participants already have a few years of experience, so this stage is not supposed to discover them, but to springboard them to a higher level in their careers.
All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival.
To those who won the golden mic here, this is a dream come true. But they say, aside from the prize, Stage Stars has marked a milestone in their pursuit of success, since they have now come under the spotlight. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
A big sit-in was held inside the Red Cross office in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike. On Sunday, scores of Palestinian prisoners started a mass hunger strike to support 2 of their fellow prisoners who have been on hunger strike for several months to protest their administrative detention. Around 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for more than 10 years. Their only recourse to draw attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food since March, and Raed Rayan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since April.
Yesterday, dozens of Palestinian detainees from different factions entered an open-ended hunger strike in solidarity with two Palestinian detainees who are going on their long hunger strike protesting the administrative detention, Khalil Awaude and Raed Rayan.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Families of Palestinian prisoners have slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of their loved ones.
I want to talk about the silence of the international community and the United Nations. I sent many letters about my son's case to all of them to intervene with the Israeli government to talk with them about my son's case, but unfortunately no response from all of them.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's treatment of the Palestinian prisoners, who are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including solitary confinement and bans on family visits.
Palestinian detainees nowadays are subjected to inhumane practices by Israeli prison services. Therefore, we are here today to convey a message to the international community, especially to the ICRC, to put pressure on the Israeli government to stop such policies and to end the Palestinian suffering, Palestinian detainees' suffering.
Many here believe that the support Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to act in contradiction with international law regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Statistics show that the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors. Among them, some 50,000 administrative detainees. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtan Al-Amamra has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus and handed him a letter from Algerian President on bilateral relations and preparations made for the upcoming Arab League summit in Algeria. Assad said the Arab League is the mirror that reflects Arabs' status quo, asserting what matters to Syria is the content and result of joint Arab action rather than the form. Amamra said Syria is a basic element on the Arab arena and that the Arab world needs Syria, not vice versa. He stressed that Algeria will remain standing beside and coordinating with Syria regarding Arab and international developments during its presidency of the Arab League summit. The top Algerian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart. The two sides agreed to boost economic cooperation and establish a joint higher committee for this purpose. However, the main topic was how to bridge gaps in the relations between Syria and some Arab countries, as Algeria is exerting efforts to bring back Syria to the Arab League.
If you ask Arabs, does Syria have a legitimate seat in the Arab League? The answer would be yes. Is Syria's absence from the Arab League in the benefit of any side? The answer is no. Syria's absence harms joint Arab action. Are there means to solve this situation? This is the core of my consultations with Arab brothers. We are optimistic.
Miqdad asserted that the issue is beyond just attending or not attending the Arab League summit.
We coordinate with Algeria and some Arab countries, regardless of Syria's membership in the Arab League. What is important now is to coordinate policies and come out with conclusions that serve Arab goals. Syria supports all measures that renew Arab stances, solidarity, and an Arab understanding of importance of joint coordination between all of us to face mutual challenges.
Algeria is one of the few Arab countries that remained supportive to Syria during its crisis, as it condemned terror and rejected economic sanctions on Syria.
This is the first official visit of an Algerian foreign minister to Syria in years. It comes as Algeria strives to unite Arab states and enhance Arab-Arab relations ahead of hosting the upcoming Arab League summit in November. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
in the limelight.
Israeli regime is feeling no international pressure to end its tightened blockade on Gaza, which entered its 15th year this summer. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading Cruelty Against Gaza Patients, Enabled by US and EU. Stay tuned for more. The Israeli regime is feeling no international pressure to end its tightened blockade on Gaza, which entered its 15th year this summer. The Jerusalem Declaration, signed by U.S. President Joe Biden and the Zionist regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid earlier this month, makes no demand on Tel Aviv to lift the siege on Gaza. In fact, it makes no direct mention of Gaza at all. The territory is only referred to indirectly, where it states that the U.S. is committed to seeking additional assistance for the Israeli regime in exceptional circumstances, such as the hostilities over 11 years in May 2021. During that week and a half, the Zionist regime inflicted yet another catastrophe on Gaza. The Israeli regime used weapons made by Boeing, a company based in Chicago, to destroy residential towers in Gaza, massacring families in their homes. Stateless Palestinians are not allowed to defend themselves from the existential threat posed by Israeli regime arms provided by the U.S. and are branded as terrorists when they do so. Meanwhile, Brussels is rewarding the Tel Aviv regime for its crimes by reviving the EU's high-level forum with the Israeli regime. No meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council, as the forum is known, have been held for a decade due to apparent friction. In 2013, the Zionist regime reacted angrily when the Brussels bureaucracy issued guidelines which seemed to bar Israeli regime bodies operating in occupied territory from reviving EU funding. Little noticed at the time, the guidelines actually contain a loophole which has allowed the Israeli regime police force and other authorities headquartered in the occupied East Al-Quds to continue and even step up their cooperation with the EU. The Israeli regime's international accomplices are seemingly content with the siege on Gaza becoming as permanent as the belligerent military occupation that began in 1967. The cruelty of the siege and depravity of those who prolong it cannot be overstated. Gaza has long been subjected to various forms of Israeli regime closure and movement restrictions over the past several decades. More than two-thirds of the some 2.1 million Palestinians who live there are refugees, denied the right to return to their homes and land in what is now called the fake regime of Israel. 16 UK charities called for an immediate end to the siege last week. This has been a devastating chapter in the decades-long fragmentation imposed on the Palestinian people, which continues to undermine their fundamental rights, the group's states. They add, with its sweeping restrictions on the entry and exit of people and goods, the deliberate policy of closure has resulted in the de-development of Gaza's economy. Gaza's population is now impoverished, with some of the highest unemployment rates in the world and more than 60% requiring food assistance. The Zionist regime siege has had disastrous effects on the lives and health of Palestinians in Gaza, as noted by Physicians for Human Rights. Nearly 850 patients died while waiting for a permit to travel outside of Gaza for life-saving treatment, according to the group. Physicians for Human Rights states that around one-third of applications for children requiring medical treatment outside Gaza were delayed or denied between January and September last year. Some 40% of boys and girls in Gaza who received medical treatment outside the territory in 2020 did so without their parents, who must also apply for Israeli regime permits to accompany their children. This is despite how the vast majority of applications for travel to access healthcare treatment were for appointments at Palestinian hospitals in East Al-Quds and elsewhere in the West Bank. According to Physicians for Human Rights, hence, accompany permits and accommodation inside the occupied territories are relevant, if anything, in very few cases. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime prevents Palestinian medical professionals from leaving Gaza for training, thereby further reducing the capacity of the highly strained healthcare sector in the territory. Physicians for Human Rights urges the removal of the Israeli permit system and the blockade over the Gaza Strip and calls for an end to the occupation. These measures are necessary for ensuring that the Palestinian healthcare system can develop as an independent, autonomous, and sustainable unit, and that all Palestinians have access to advanced medical treatment.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
While the world continues to condemn Russia's special military operation against Ukraine, Russia provides its reasons for continuing that operation. In the latest, Russia has said that it had hit a Ukrainian warship and a weapons store in Odessa with its high-precision missiles. Two attacks have taken place in Odessa by Russia. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the developments coming out of this conflict, which consists of continuing energy shortages for EU countries, and whether the U.S. provocative moves can prove to be one too many for Russia to counter-react with what the former Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev once said the U.S. may receive a Judgment Day response. Our guests for this edition of the Spotlight are Ray McGovern joins us. He's a former CIA analyst who joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also joining us is Jeff Brown, radio host and journalist who joins us from Normandy. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me first start with you, Ray McGovern, if I may. We're looking first at this incident that has happened twice in the port city of Odessa, where you have Russian, after signing that grain deal for wheat, et cetera, to target it. But it has said that the missiles did not hit the port's grain storage in the first incident and did not cause significant damage, and the other to actually have targeted what Russia has said is an area that held some U.S. weapons. Russia has its reasons. How do you see this strike by Russia, of which it's being blamed for now by the entire world practically?
Well, it's very hard to know. Russia does have its reasons. The question is whether those were ammo dumps and supplies and so forth. And we will not know that because we have no journalists worth the name in that part of Ukraine. There's a backstory to this grain deal, and that is that even though Russia has been blamed for preventing the export of grain, it was the mines that Ukraine laid in the access to Odessa that really made it impossible for the grain ships to be insured on the one hand, and then to go get the grain and bring it out. That has been resolved now. There's a channel that has been cleared of mines. The Russian foreign minister worked this out with the UN Secretary General 2 weeks ago, okay? Why doesn't the UN Secretary General acknowledge that? Well, We all know why. So the deal is good, but it could have been done weeks ago if there was an agreement by the Ukrainians to clear the mines that they had laid in the approaches to Odessa.
Okay, let's take a look at the military aspect of this war, Jeff Brown, if we may, in terms of how things stand when you compare the Russian army versus the Ukrainian army. Based on just the latest, just a few aspects of the numbers, the Russian military, 771,000 active military personnel versus Ukraine's roughly 200,000. These are rough numbers. Russia's total tanks, 20,000. A little bit more than that, 20,050 versus 2,045 for the Ukrainian side. This is skewed heavily in favor of Russia to the point where it's kind of hard to really imagine Ukraine catching up when you have these kinds of numbers in favor of Russia. What kind of strategy could there then be in the Ukrainian officials' minds to continue this war?
The president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, recently said in a groundbreaking speech, and I wish we could talk about it, but we don't. This is not the time to do it. But he said that that NATO wants to defeat Russia, and he said, "Okay, go ahead and try. We haven't even really started." So all of this propaganda from the West about the Russians, they can't move and they can't advance, and they, et cetera, they are using a little finger's worth of their military might. The U.S. and NATO thought that Russia was going to run out of high-precision missiles in 2 weeks. The Russians learned in World War II that you'd never run out of ammunition, and they never did, and they're not going to run out of ammunition now. This is not about Ukraine. This is about the West trying to save Western imperialism, global capitalism. This is way, way beyond Ukraine now. And it's pretty clear to me that Russia, they're taking their sweet time. The West thought that it was going to deplete Russian resources. Russia is basically toying with the West like a cat and a mouse, and they are the Russians are now depleting Western resources, And Shoigu, the Minister of Defense, was just in Donbass last week and said, time to move further west and beyond Donbass to get Ukrainians away from the Donbass so that their missiles can quit slaughtering innocent victims. Russia has already won, NATO has already lost, and Russia is going to bleed NATO dry until it has no more ammunition left.
Okay, well, that puts another aspect to this, Ray McGovern, if you agree, because I was going to ask you about the fact that, what kind of goals would Russia have? They set out wanting that eastern part, but as our guests there indicated, their aspirations are not beyond that. But he put a twist in there, if I may call it that, that it wants to deplete the West, in particular the U.S., and then in turn, by default almost, EU countries' resources. Is that what Russia now intends to do, or maybe it has had that plan way before?
Well, there are three very important things that happened this past week, and I want to name them before we run out of time. One was the Iranian statement that they fully support Russia and its aims in Ukraine. Two was the Chinese foreign ministry statement saying the same thing. Real big events. The third one plays into what's going on in the ground. Now, on the same day, oddly enough, Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov from Russia said, we're going to expand our aims. We said we'd settle for Donetsk and Lugansk. No. We've got Zaporozhye. We've got other places farther to the west. And we're going to move ahead. And the reason we're going to move ahead and change our original designs or aims is because of the presence of HIMARS. Now, he singled out this rocket system by mentioning HIMARS. Now, here's the crux here. What's HIMARS? Well, that's a rocket system that has a range of about 50 miles. That's dangerous. Now, why did he mention that? Because the U.S. is giving HIMARS to the Ukrainians, and at the same time, on the same day, the Defense Secretary of the United States said, and I quote, "When I heard the news that Russia was expanding its aims in Ukraine, I thought, well, I'll bet the Ukrainian leadership is really happy about how effective our HIMARS are and that they know how to use them." Now, nobody has put two and two together. In other words,
you can do it HIMARS,
Lavrov was saying, is occasioning an expansion of Russian aims, and the Defense Secretary of the United States doesn't seem to realize the implications of this. He's more engaged in a rhetorical system as how good the Ukrainian leadership might feel. My friends who know a lot about military affairs say that HIMARS is no magic bullet. It's not going to change much, and it will encourage the Russians to go farther than I believe they intended to.
Well, HIMARS, I'm glad you explained that, Ray McGovern. Another thing that it does have, from what we understand here, is that it is, I think each has six GPS radars. It's very precision-guided in that respect. So Russia, in part, did have a reaction in terms of what you mentioned about Lavrov. Now, one of the things that maybe, Jeff Brown, maybe points to the fact that the U.S. and NATO together want this war to continue is perhaps the piece of news that came out, this was at this point a couple weeks old, how British forces have begun training Ukrainian soldiers to the tune of 10,000 of them in order to make sure that they will get the special military training, which obviously involves using the equipment that they have no idea how to use. Do you think, and that's going to take time, I'm guessing, when you train that many. Is that one of the reasons perhaps why the U.S. and NATO member countries want this war to continue at this point, to give them a chance of trying to defeat Russia?
You're asking me?
Yes, Jeff Brown. Go ahead.
Well,
NATO must be absolutely delusional to think that they're going to win this war. And it's, yeah, they think they're buying time. I think it's the Russians that are buying time, and they can train 100,000 people in London, and it's not going to change the outcome of what's going to happen in Ukraine. The Russians have applied a tiny percentage of their capability. They could bomb the Ministry of Defense and the nerve center of the Ukrainian army in Kiev with their precision missiles and hurt almost no one. They haven't even begun to really stretch things out here. And with Shoigu and, as Ray mentioned, Lavrov, you know, talking about moving further west. I mean, between all of us, I think in 5 years, Russia's going to have elite tank divisions on the borders with Romania, Hungary, Slovakia, and Poland. They're going to end up with the entire Ukrainian landmass, because the West is simply not going to stop trying to destroy Russia, failing the entire way. And the only way to stop it is to get to the EU border. And I think that's what will happen in the next 5 years. I think it's just a matter, it's just an eventuality, because the West will not stop.
Well, Ray McGovern, let me see what you think about what the former Medvedev has said in terms of the possibility of Crimea being attacked with these HIMARS weapons, because that's one of the things that was mentioned by Zelensky, of which he said that will ignite Judgment Day response. Judgment Day will come very fast and hard. It will be very difficult to hide. Can you please tell us what he means by Judgment Day?
Well, Medvedev has been the bad cop over the last several months. In other words, he's been given the task to issue pointed warnings. Now, as I mentioned, the HIMARS, for example, have a range of 50 miles. Now, you put them somewhere near Crimea, and they can do a lot of damage. They can't reach that bridge just yet unless they, well, no, I don't think they can have the range for that. But there are other rocket systems that the U.S. could provide. I'm not looking at a horizon of 5 years. I can't think in those terms. I'm thinking of a horizon of several months, and the key juncture is the U.S. midterm elections. By November, when the elections take place, the West is going to be losing profoundly. And there will be great pressure on Biden and his military to do something even worse than HIMARS. And that concerns me greatly, because if they escalate all the way to more advanced systems, which can go 200 miles, then Russia itself and that bridge that connects Russia with Crimea are in jeopardy. So this escalation, which I believe really started just this week on the 20th, when Lavrov said we're going farther, and the defense secretary of the United States said, the Ukrainians will be very happy to hear that, because our weapons are working, and that's why they're going farther. Well, doesn't he? How is he advising the American president? Is he telling Mr. Biden, hey, we got to be prepared for some really bad results here? When they go farther west, they're going to take Odessa. They may go as far as Moldova. And, this is a real problem. It's not a rhetorical exercise. Does he tell Biden that? I'm not sure he has the brains to do that. He's no smarter than Blinken, Secretary of State. And that's an invidious comparison.
Well, you have other statements made. For example, Jeff Brown, this question for you, where Zelensky has promised Ukraine will not give up as the Russian invasion at this point is entering the 6 months. On the same day, which is today, you had the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine say, Washington will support Kiev for as long as it takes. So we're trying to figure out a timeline. Ray McGovern says a couple of months. I think you made a reference, Jeff Brown, to years. Do you really think it will take years?
Well, I said 5 years that the map will be changed in 5 years, and Ukraine will be reintegrated into the Russian Federation, where into the motherland where Ukraine was for centuries. And in fact, Russian Orthodox Christianity began in Crimea. So there's a lot of history with Russia there. I just don't see any other choice for Russia than to just keep pushing. I mean, they could do what the United States does, and that, flatten everybody and kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people, like they did in Iraq and Libya, and what they're doing in Syria, etc. But they're trying to save civilian lives. They're trying to save civilian infrastructure. And since the Ukrainian Nazis put all of their personnel and equipment in churches and hospitals and apartment blocks and other sensitive sites, it really frustrates the Russians. They could roll to Lviv in a month or two if they wanted to wage war like the United States typically does, which is no regard for civilian life and no regard for for infrastructure. So I think Russia is thinking in years. I think they know they are going to deplete NATO's weaponry. There's even Raytheon and the other manufacturers are saying it's going to take him 3, 4, 5 years to replace what's already been sent to Ukraine. How are they going to get all that back? And as far as Zelensky is concerned, he and his mafia crony that manipulates him like a puppet, they're making billions off of this thing. They are making billions, raking money off of all of these arms and stuff coming into the country. So he loves what's going on, because he's becoming even a bigger billionaire than he already is, and his mafia boss who works with him. So that's my assessment. I really hope Russia does roll all the way to the border of Poland. And because that's what it's going to take to bring Western Empire to its knees.
Mm-hmm. Ray McGovern, you have something to say, it seems like. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment on that and to warn that there could be what Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, warned just this week, a false flag, an unanticipated event, the kind of thing that change things dramatically. I have in mind Zaporozhye, where there are many nuclear structures there. The Ukrainian Nazis are crazy. It is not beyond their capability or their intention, in my view, to strike one of those nuclear sites, to blame it on the Russians, and everything changes, because now the Russians have attacked the nuclear facilities in Ukraine, and there are many of them. So I just warn that things could change rapidly, and Lavrov himself is warning in a very pointed way about these staged events to prevent the inexorable advance of the Russian army.
So what kind of response will we get, supposedly, if what you're speculating happens?
Well, that's just it. I have no confidence that Biden is up to responding to this. As a matter of fact, Lavrov himself has said in a recent interview, Biden is not in charge. Who's doing this are the top of the State Department and one or two people in the White House. They have ample proof of that, because Biden has gone back on some of his promises, almost certainly due to pressure from the military-industrial complex, as well as State Department and one or two in the White House. So they have no confidence in Biden, neither do I. And this raises a really explosive situation if a unplanned or a false flag attack happens. And as I say, it doesn't have to be a nuclear thing. It could be all kinds of other things like chemical attacks, such as the ones that were staged in Syria.
Indeed. Well, there was another explosion that it kind of has been swept under the rug, but it is pretty noteworthy, and that is the treason that was noted inside the Ukrainian government, where President Volodymyr Zelensky dismissed the security chief and also the prosecutor general, and he said that there are roughly around 650 cases involving officials that are suspected of treason, aiding Russia. How big a deal is that, Jeff Brown?
You know, Zelensky, it's a sad commentary that this Nazi sympathizer is the most powerful leader in the Western world right now. It's tragic. And who knows? You know, there's so much corruption. There is so much money, you know, money laundering going on in Ukraine. Ukraine is the biggest washing machine for the West for money laundering. It could be he just needs to, you know, get some guys out who are not, you know, cooperating with him and putting in some of his cronies. I have no idea. And it's also, you know, optics to look good, like he's trying to save Ukraine. So I really can't say, and who knows. And whether they even left or not, it may have just been a psychological operation that he asked these
okay.
guys to leave.
Let me cut you and give Ray McGovern a chance, and you could respond. And with that, that'll be the last question. Ray McGovern, go ahead.
I could easily catch this in terms of a staged event. Now, what happened was real. Okay, Lavrov himself, in his major statement this week, talked about Zelensky or whoever comes in to replace him, okay? Gratuitous remark. There's going to be someone coming in to replace him, and you know the Russians are afraid of being blamed for that. They've avoided that so far, and Zelensky, please remember, is not his own man. He's pulled by strings in Washington and in Brussels, and also by the Azov people, the Nazis, against whom he has to be very, very afraid, because he's vulnerable from both sides, the right and the left.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst. Jeff Brown, thank you so much, radio host and journalist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kovetapwe and the team, it's goodbye.